KaiserNetwork.org.
I now turn you back to the wonderful chair of this working group, for whom I think we all ought to say thank you, Gail Smith.
When I worked for Sandy, that's how we started out every morning. He gave me a round of applause. Okay, we're going to start the next panel and move very quickly. So, Arturo, I turn over to you, and thank you all for your attention.
Ladies and gentlemen, we continue now with our next panelist, Right Honorable Gordon Brown, Chancellor of the Exchequer, United Kingdom. Maria Otero, President and CEO, Acción International. Darren Walker, Vice President, the Rockefeller Foundation. And our moderator again is James Wolfenson, Chairman, Wolfenson and Company, LLC.
Sorry that Sandy forgot to give me an award. I feel very much left out of this whole thing. We're into the second phase of our really extremely interesting afternoon session, and my task is to get out of the way as quickly as possible because we have three remarkable speakers from three different aspects of the issue of, it's called Leveraging Big Money. It's not a very good title, but each of our speakers will give us some idea of how they've brought leverage to the situation, and I'd like to start first, of course, with Gordon Brown, who's the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and as such has more money than any of the other participants on the panel. Gordon is going to... I should just tell you about Gordon Brown just for one second. He is not just a Chancellor of the Exchequer. He is a visionary in terms of development and probably my greatest partner in the work that I did at the bank. He would take all my ideas and then pretend they were his and then put them over so much better than I could that I was forgotten. But the important thing was that as Chancellor of the Exchequer, people listened to him. And he had a few ideas of his own, too. So let me say, Gordon, thank you for everything that you did when we were together. I'd love it if you could tell us something about the strategic view that you have on the New Deal that you put forward, how you see it playing out. What is your vision?
Can I say, first of all, what a pleasure it is to be here at such a wonderful session with such great participants with me on the stage. And Jim, if we achieve anything today, it's because we are standing on the shoulders of a giant. And your work as president of the World Bank is respected in every continent of the world. I'm also fascinated by the generosity of the American business community and everybody who has given to the causes that you just mentioned a few minutes ago. And it's a far cry from what has happened in Britain in previous years. The story is told of Henry Ford when he opened his factory first in Britain. And he came to the United, he was coming to the United Kingdom for the official opening. And the mayor of the local town thought it was a chance for corporate charity to be visited upon his town, and he wanted him to donate money to a local old people's home. So he wired Henry Ford in Detroit and said, Henry Ford, would you give me $20,000 to build an old people's home in my constituency in Dagenham? No reply from Henry Ford. And then he became more modest and he wired Henry Ford and said, will you give me $10,000 for an old people's home that I want to build to celebrate the coming of Ford Motor Company to Dagenham? Still no reply. So on the day of the opening of the car factory and Henry Ford just about to arrive in Britain, the mayor simply announced that Henry Ford had decided to give $20,000. And for once, Henry Ford, this great car owner, for once he was stumped and didn't know what to do. So he arrived at the official opening and he said to the mayor, I will give you $20,000 and I will give you it for the old people's home, but I have one condition, that a plaque is put outside the old people's home, and I only ask you to put one inscription, a biblical text, Matthew chapter 14, verse 12, I was a stranger and you took me in. Now, corporate charity has improved. And I'm very grateful to everybody who's given to the great causes that have been announced today. Churchill, our Prime Minister, once said of his own country in the 1930s that we were resolved to be irresolute, he said, adamant for drift, solid for fluidity, and all-powerful for impotence. And my fear is if we do not wake up to the need for a new deal between the richest countries and the poor countries soon, then we will find that what we thought was a moral imperative has become very quickly a strategic imperative. Because I'm struck, if I was speaking here last year, I would have talked about finance for African developing countries and closing the gap between rich and poor in ethical terms. But I'm struck by what's happened in the last year, and I think Jim is very much aware of this as well, that we are seeing more Al-Qaeda bases in Africa than in any other part of the world. We're seeing immigration from Africa into Europe because we cannot guarantee that there will be prosperity in Africa. We're seeing China playing power politics in Africa, lending money and almost negating the debt relief that has been agreed over the recent years. And of course, at the same time, we have an environmental catastrophe that Africa is very much part of, but we've neglected. So my point today is that the new deal that is necessary between rich countries and poor countries, through the innovative financing that I hope that we can talk about in a few minutes, is now a strategic as well as moral imperative for the United States of America, for Europe, and for the rest of the industrialized world. And the problem, just to finish this point, the problem we have got in Africa is that while the private sector must be built up, the only hope for growth in the long run is the private sector. The work that's been done by the Commission for the Legal Empowerment of the Poor, and I hope that many of that commission are represented here today, and the work that has been done on microcredit that is extremely important to the future, that is all absolutely crucial to the long term of Africa and to build up a culture in which entrepreneurship can fully flourish. But unless this is accompanied by public investment, because private investment can only meet at the moment 10% of the needs for infrastructure in Africa, then it will take so long for us to catch up that we will have these strategic imperatives visited upon us. And that's why we are proposing that we help finance education for every single primary school pupil of age for primary school in Africa. It only costs $100 a child to educate each for a year's education for a primary school child. That's why we're, and the commission and the committee that is promoting education for all, and Jean Sperling's here, can show exactly the difference that can be made. That's why we are also promoting the health initiatives that I believe are absolutely crucial for a healthy as well as educated workforce. And our proposals working with IFIM and Gavi for immunization, and Bill Gates has contributed largely to making this possible with eight other governments around the world, will vaccinate 500 million children over the next 15 years, and it is an investment that we've got to make. And that's why also, and I'd like to be able to explain it at some point during the discussion, our proposals for innovative finance for medicine, and I'm glad that Paul Martin is here, the former Prime Minister of Canada, because he has been leading on this, and it was a privilege to work with him on this. The proposals for innovative finance for medicine mean that we can develop drugs and have mass production of drugs. So instead of large prices and small output of drugs and treatments for healthcare in Africa, we can have mass production and lower prices. And these three innovative ways that we can provide education and health that can make a difference to the development of both infrastructure in Africa and the development of the economy are, in my view, one of the biggest contributions we can make, not just to the moral imperative of building a bridge between rich and poor, but the strategic need to deal with what will be a problem that will be visited upon us if we don't act now.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Gordon, for those remarks and also for your leadership. And the fact that Paul is here, I think maybe when we finish this round, we'll give Paul 2 minutes to make some comments too, because, as you said, he has been a leader in this field as well. We now come to the contribution of Maria Otero, who in her own way is one of the great leaders in microcredit and in many other things, I might add. She has brought together more than 26 microfinance institutions in 20 countries. But beyond that, I think one really needs to see her as a spiritual as well as a practical head of this movement. And I think we're all very anxious to hear from you, Maria.
Thank you, Jim. You have no idea what it feels like to sit up here in this panel, surrounded by especially Jim and Gordon Brown, who are such enormous leaders in what they are doing and who are so inspiring to us, and having someone who's done so much work on behalf of the poor, it really, it's humbling. And I think one of the things that occurs to me as we listen to the conversations that we have heard yesterday and today is that microfinance comes up often as one of the areas that has been very successful. And it occurs to me that most people really don't know why it has been successful and what milestones it has overcome in order to be able to accomplish what it has. And perhaps in 2 minutes it's important to summarize that, because it has, microfinance, with what it has accomplished, has really broken through the assumptions and broken through the established way of thinking in order to get to what it has gotten. And the first things that it did, really, was, and this was one of the pushes that Acción had from the beginning, was how to create institutions that would be sustainable and that would make very, very small loans to very poor people and would be able to help them develop their businesses and really lift themselves out of poverty. What De Soto talked about yesterday when he talked about the micro-entrepreneur with a little tie and the little coat, in fact, the micro-entrepreneur is really a person living in a home surrounded by a family of four or five people with a dirt floor, with very little skills, with very few possibilities of finding any kind of employment except his own. So whether it's a woman that's selling onions on the street, whether it's a man that is making some chairs or tables as a carpenter, there are millions and millions, if not billions, of people working this way. So that the idea of making capital available to them, credit available, required that we figure out a way to do it in a sustainable way that was going to take you to reach large, large numbers. What microfinance did, and Acción played a role in this, was it really took concepts that we all accept and it turned them upside down. It took the banking concept of collateral, you need collateral to borrow, and the concept of risk, you can only assume so much risk when you're lending, and it just took them upside down and figured out a way to cover them. It took the concept of development, where you really would not consider charging an interest rate to a poor person, because how will they pay it back, and turned that upside down and said, indeed, we need to charge an interest rate. And it took the concept that the poor can't pay back loans and said, indeed, they can pay them back if you're able to do this forward. So with these concepts, with these innovative ways of thinking, it really was able to create some of the first sustainable organizations that cover their cost. But the real milestone, I think, is when it realized that what it had to do was connect what we were doing to the capital markets, because the capital markets were going to provide the resources needed, the firepower needed to be able to fund the billions of people that you needed to reach. So the first commercial bank from microfinance was created really only about 14 years ago in Bolivia, my own country, where we are not used to be the first ones in doing anything, certainly not anything that will become an example to the rest of the world. But Banco Sol became the first commercial bank that was fully regulated and that was supervised by the supervisory agencies. And as a bank making very tiny loans to women who signed their loan applications with their thumb and who really needed very little in order to make it, this bank did several things which are at the core of the innovations that we're looking at today. And I just mentioned three of them that are essential. The first one is it put the word profitable, that dirty P word, with the word poor. It created a bank that was meaning to be a profitable bank that was only going to reach the poor. And it was going to be profitable because it was going to demonstrate that you could not only get returns, but that this was the only way to really develop this with a business model that would work over time. By being a bank, this bank could now capture savings. It could borrow from the local markets. It could borrow from the international markets. It could even issue its own paper. And thereby, it had all the capital it needed to be able to grow and address that question that's at the core of what we're doing, which is how do we reach millions and millions of people? And it became an example for many other institutions around the world, which started to also use this model to develop. So what we have had then has been the breaking through of some really serious bottlenecks in order to get to the point where you have a combination of using business principles with reaching the poor. In other words, being able to take something that provides economic value, just the returns that you get, with a social value, which is addressing the needs of very poor households. And this model is for Acción interesting because it really took us about 20 years to reach the first 1 million people with the institutions that we created. But it took us 3 years to reach the second 1 million. And when we start talking about innovations, we begin to think that this is nowhere near enough. It's wonderful and it's moving us in the direction of scale that we never thought could happen. But it is before us to find additional ways to tap into that capital, to leverage even bigger money, and at the same time to take the resources, the financial products that we are being able to make available to the poor and expand them way beyond what we're doing right now. So I think I would just end and think that we will be able to have some opportunity to talk about some of these innovations that I think are so important and the reason why so many private entities are coming into this effort. Certainly, for example, Citigroup, which is one that is playing such an important role in this initiative, is now an important player in looking and working in microfinance. You find other banks around the world entering this effort as well. And you see that as we work and as we look at the partnerships that we're bringing together, it is really this philosophy of innovation that is at the core of what microfinance is doing. So our story is not at all told yet. We are still in a process of really addressing many of the challenges that we face.
Well, thank you very much for that inspiring contribution. As in the last session, we had some examples of innovation in the United States. So in this session, we're thrilled to have Darren Walker with us, who's a vice president of the Rockefeller Foundation. Before that, he was a banker, but during all this time has done great work with the Abyssinian Church, has done great work in Harlem. And what we'd appreciate, Darren, is if you could give us some insights into both your domestic activities and, if possible, any suggestions you might have for the broader community that's here.
Thank you. Good afternoon. It really is a privilege for me to be on this stage with Maria and these two icons in Jim Wolfenson and the Chancellor. And what they didn't tell you was that I know both of them because not the Rockefeller Foundation, but because they came to Harlem in the 1990s when a lot of people didn't want to come to Harlem. And they came because they were interested in what we on the ground at the Abyssinian Church was doing to help revitalize our community. And I remember the last visit when I saw the Chancellor, and you were very interested in how we were able to do our work. And I voiced a frustration that I was frustrated by the incrementalism, by the inability of my organization to move beyond 10 or 15 units of housing and to really work at scale. And when I came to the Rockefeller Foundation, I found a real platform to really develop a more systemic and scalable response to this challenge. And I have to say it's been wonderful having a supportive organization and a fantastic leader in Judith Roden, who is really, really interested in this question of scale and finance. And what I would say about partnership is, as a foundation that fundamentally believes everything you just said, Chancellor Brown, about the importance and the vitality of the private sector and partnering with the private sector, many of us don't really understand the private sector and how it operates. For many organizations, particularly on the ground, the private sector is a black box. And the more we can unpack and understand risk, which Maria's organization has mastered beautifully, understanding risk, that these are institutions that exist to make money, and they have to manage their risk. So what we did at the foundation was to work with a group of foundations in New York City, with lenders, with the city of New York, to respond to a crisis that we have in this city around affordable housing and the difficulty of responding to the reality of a very, very hot housing market where there is no land, where the city, which once owned over 40,000 units of housing in disinvested neighborhoods like Central Harlem and the South Bronx, those units of housing have all been developed. So we find ourselves at, really on some levels, a perfect storm where the policies that have been so vital to helping advance and develop affordable housing for poor and vulnerable people are either flat or being reduced. And the cost of land, the cost of development has increased. So what we did was to create a new sort of model that helped to organize a pool of funds. In this case, the pilot, which was just closed, was a $40 million investment by a group of foundations, which was leveraged 5 times, and that will create a $200 million risk mitigation structure. That construct will generate the development of over 30,000 units of housing. And what's interesting about this, and what is generalizable, and there are, in fact, lessons for the global community around housing and shelter, is that we structured the pool in a way that encouraged and incentivized and, quite frankly, helped to manage the risk of the private sector, who in the final analysis are going to make the loans to build the housing. And I won't get into the details of the exact structure on a transaction basis, but what I will tell you is that it makes it much simpler for the financial institutions to actually make loans. It's more efficient, and it can generate in volume significantly more loans than the banks would be doing if they were individually rather than as a pool doing the loans. Another thing that it does is, because of the risk amount that the banks, that the foundations have put in, it makes it possible for the banks to loan at a discounted rate. So the way we have structured this makes it possible in the final analysis to more efficiently and more effectively develop housing. The reality, of course, is that policy matters here. And your statement about the importance of housing policy, of finance policy, cannot be underscored enough. It is, while I come out of the private sector and I am an advocate of partnerships, without strong, competent, and smart government partners, it is very, very hard for us in philanthropy and in the private sector to do this work. So I would only say that I think for foundations, we believe that philanthropy should be moving more towards partnership, should be moving more towards providing the incentives that really set the table for more development. And hopefully we'll be able to do more of that in the future.
Well, thank you very much, Darren. And I think, again, you have hit on some themes that we've been hearing, one of which is that if you create the right environment, the poor, and this comes through in all our sessions here, the poor are creditworthy. I think, Maria, you've had that experience in microcredit. You had 98% or something like that repayment. And if you can put in the insurance or the enrichment, as you call it, the risk mitigation factor that comes from a public-private partnership, then we can turn a group of people that we had previously not thought of as creditworthy into an extremely creditworthy group if we can work the mechanics of the delivery. I wonder if I might break the rules, but I may never get asked back again, but ask Paul Martin just to comment, because Gordon and I would love to have him say something. He's the former Prime Minister of Canada and did a hell of a lot in this field and deserves 2 minutes, which is what we can give you, Paul.
Well, thank you, Jim. It's a wonderful introduction saying that I'm going to ask Paul Martin to speak and I, Jim Wilkinson, will never be asked back again. But let me just make two comments then very quickly, one on the private sector and the other on the public sector. I'll speak in the private sector because having spent the better part of a decade, more than that, in the public sector, I am now somewhat unwillingly back into the private sector. So the points that I would really make on the private sector is as follows. John Bryant, who was here earlier, talked about when he wanted to, after the race riots in California, when he wanted to rebuild his area, he was able to put about some 300 bankers into a couple of buses and take them through and show them just exactly what he thought that they should be lending into. I think that really does demonstrate the degree to which the private sector's capacity in a place like the United States, Canada, or the United Kingdom is very different than it is in most developing countries. You're not going to get 300 bankers and a couple of buses going through most developing countries. You're not going to get the kind of mentoring that a large corporation will provide to people in its own country if there are no great multinationals understanding the need for mentoring. You're not going to get people leaving a multinational or leaving a corporation to go do their own spin-off, their own startup, if in fact that isn't the ethic and that's not the way that they work. And so I do believe that there has to be a very different approach to private sector, for-profit development in a developing country. They haven't got the capital, they haven't got the mentoring, and unless we attack that problem directly, I think that we're really not going to deal with poverty alleviation in the way that we should. The second point that I would make has to do with the public sector. If you go out and talk to the electorate, they will really tell you that it doesn't make a lot of difference who you elect, it doesn't make a lot of difference who is appointed. I want to say, having watched the World Bank under Jim Wolfensohn, and having served as a finance minister with the Chancellor of the Exchequer for the better part of a decade, both at G7 meetings and at the IMF and the World Bank, the IMF of which Gordon Brown was the head of the newly constituted interim committee. Let me tell you that an individual in place makes an enormous difference. Policy is important, no doubt about that. But if you put the right individual in charge of the World Bank, if you make the right individual Chancellor of the Exchequer, and then give that person all the leeway at a G7 meeting, which is a very powerful operation for finance ministers, if you give that person at the IMF the capacity to put their vision into place, and you get things like the Commission for Africa, then what you really do begin to see progress. So the only point that I would make on the public sector is pretty simple. Put the right people in place. And I've got to say, with these two in place, that's what happened. Thank you.
I want you to know that I wrote those remarks for Paul, and you did them, Paul, you did them extremely well. But I'd like to give Gordon a minute, and then I'm going to give Maria also a comment. Gordon.
It's wonderful to hear Paul Martin, and he did a superb job in both the G7, in the G20, and in the IMFC, and I'm very grateful to him for everything that he achieved. Development finance is almost inevitably short-term, unpredictable, and not necessarily sustained. And it's because of that that it makes it very difficult, without innovative forms of financing and without public-private partnerships at work, to do the things that you want to do. And of course, there's another problem of development finance, and Paul and I know very well what it is, that promises that are made, and sometimes made in the heat of the moment at conferences, and Jim knows all about that, are not always delivered. Martin Luther King used to describe the American Constitution as a promissory note when he was talking about civil rights, and that the check promising money had been returned to the black community with the words insufficient funds marked upon it. And that has been the history of development finance, promises made but never delivered. So we've been trying to find a means by which you can have long-term, predictable, sustainable finance for projects that are worthwhile, properly administered, properly building up the capacity of countries to be able to do things for themselves. And obviously, we've also been trying to find a way by which we can leverage in both private and public finance to get the maximum benefit. And I just give you three very quick examples of how it can work. The finance facility for immunization. We realized very quickly, working with the Gates Foundation, that if you could achieve 100% immunization in a year or two in a particular area, it was far better medically and far better to avoid the contagion of disease than 10% vaccinated every year. So the advantages of front-loading funds for vaccination are both enormous medically and, of course, to the benefit of any economy where they have a healthy workforce. And what we have managed to do is to front-load finance for vaccination through the Gavi Fund, Gratia Michel, many governments, the Gates Foundation, a $4 billion extra front-loading that means we will be able to vaccinate 500 million children over the next 15 years. It means, according to the estimates done by independent people, that 5 million lives that would otherwise not be saved will be saved. And that is an incredible thing to say you can achieve from one initiative. And what I believe it shows you is that if you can persuade governments to make both long-term commitments and at the same time to leverage in with the support, and there's been great support from the financial institutions, leverage in money from the private sector, then what is possible in development finance is just so much greater. And I believe that that model for vaccination could be applied more widely as well. The second example of an issue we're dealing with is essentially a market failure. Only 10% of research and development that is done for medical drugs is done for drugs that can help the developing countries, although they are 90% of the population. And therefore, you've got to find a way to make it attractive to do research and development and at the same time to achieve the mass production of a drug or a treatment that would otherwise come at such a price that no developing country could afford it. So we are pioneering what is called advanced market mechanisms with the support of the G7, initially for a drug pneumococcus, for a disease pneumococcus, and eventually, we believe, for malaria. And the potential of this is 1 million children die a year from pneumococcus, 1.5 million from malaria, both treatable diseases if we can get the preventative vaccines right. The Gates Foundation is now sponsoring the research and development for an anti-malaria drug. The research and development has virtually been done for a pneumococcus drug, and what we need then to do is to be able to finance mass production. But by leveraging in funds from governments that underpin the market, we are now in a position to reach agreements with pharmaceutical companies who are all for this, so that drugs can be made available. Another example of a private-public partnership at work. The final example I give is education. There is no way you can plan an education system for a year, 2 years, or 3 years, which is what development finance has traditionally been about. And there's no way that the World Bank, and Jim did the Fast Track Initiative, which is a wonderful initiative, can do it on its own. So we need commitments for the longer term, either public, private, or public commitments, so that countries can build up the capacity in their education system. They can agree to train teachers, which takes several years. They can make commitments to build schools, and they can build capacity in the education system in their countries. Now, there are 100 million children not going to school today. It costs $100 at the moment per child per year only to educate a child. If the political will is there, then governments throughout Africa and the developing countries can be persuaded to make these long-term investments. We have persuaded 15 governments in Africa, and more are about to come, to submit their long-term plans. They have said they are prepared to put up $50 billion over the next 10 years to move to universal primary education. But the cost of it is in something in the order of $80 to $90 billion, and that requires a commitment from the richest countries. Now, it may be we could have an international finance facility over the longer term that could provide private as well as public finance for it. But it's clear to me that you need a long-term commitment from governments in the richest countries if you are going to make it possible to move to a universal primary education commitment for all. And that's why we, Britain, have made a unilateral commitment of $15 billion over the next 10 years. That in itself will educate 15 million children. But that's why we're trying to persuade other countries, and we have Netherlands, Norway, Sweden, and other countries joining at the moment, so that we can actually make a long-term, sustainable, predictable finance available for education. What I find amazing when I look at this is that there is really no scientific barrier to solving the problems that we're talking about. No technological barrier, no medical barrier. Actually, when you look at it, innovative finance shows that there is no financial barrier, and microcredit is showing how innovative things can be done at a small business level, and I've seen it. I've seen it at firsthand in Tanzania, where under your inspiration, 40,000 mothers are involved in a microcredit project that is yielding huge advances for the Tanzania people, and it's interesting, it is women in Africa that are now making the difference. But what I think we've had lacking over these last few years is a political will. And we need the business community as much as the general public to keep pressing and saying, look, if we can find innovative solutions in other areas, we can find solutions for the most basic of things, education for school children and healthcare for all. Thanks very much.
Well, I hope you don't mind, and the organizers don't mind, my not cutting you off, Gordon, because that was a fabulous statement, and I hope presages your ability to do this on a broader stage sometime soon. Maria wanted 1 minute, and then we're going to let all of you to the difficult work. Maria, one minute.
I'm just reminded by what the Chancellor said about what microfinance unleashes. And I'm reminded of a very quick story of a time that I had to take a delegation of people to visit a microenterprise in Guatemala. And we walked into the home of a woman with a dirt floor, with no windows. She was making shoes. She was very poor. And she was showing her microenterprise to the delegation that I brought. One of the members of the delegation was a business professor, and he looked at the shoes being made there and looked at this woman, and he said, Maria, I was translating, would you ask her what her unit cost of production is? And this business professor, who was Texan, he was very tall, stood there, and I said, no, I will not ask her that. I will not embarrass her in front of her children. I can't do that. He insisted, and I turned to her, and I apologized. I said, please excuse me, but this gringo, you know, this is asking, what is your unit cost of production? Could you tell him? And she looked up at him. He was twice her height. And she said, of course I can tell you what my unit cost of production is. It's 20 quetzales. And come with me, and I will show you at each step of the production process where each quetzal is. I tell you this story because we forget what power we unleash when we put resources into the hands of poor people. And that is really what microfinance is trying to do. And our challenge, as we are trying to do it, is how to reach much greater scale. And here we need to bring technology in to see how we can get this into really faraway areas. We need to bring in different ways in which we can also develop products like insurance, like home improvement, like ways in which we can reach people in rural areas. So our work is really just beginning. And the capital markets, providing the debt, providing the possibility of securitizing microfinance, which I know BRAC has already done in Bangladesh, really shows us promise of how to take this innovation and really take it to another level. But it's that woman in Guatemala or in Tanzania that is really going to make the difference, and they are really at the core of what inspires us to do the work that we do.
Thank you very much, Maria. I should now tell you that the organizers may not allow me to come back because I have ruined everything here, and the timetable particularly. But if I'm permitted to come back, I will. But in the meantime...
I'd like to announce that for his sins, Jim Wolfenson will be forced to come back. Thank you, Jim. And we are on a slightly faster clock than we have been. But what we'd like to give you the chance to do is do some of the table discussion so that we can bring that back to our panelists. We do need to end promptly on time to make the rest of the program work. But Jim, you are absolutely not only forgiven but thanked for that, because I think what's come out of this discussion is invaluable. Now, we've heard from all three of our panelists about ways of leveraging the capital we need, whether it's through microfinance and marrying the words profit and poor, as Maria said, whether it's, as Darren spoke about structuring pools of financing in creative ways that mitigate risk and therefore give you more reach. the Chancellor talked not only about this interesting airline tax, but his own leadership, and I think truly revolutionary leadership, in using the market to leverage the kind of financing we need for the vaccines that should be available to everyone on Earth. So what we want to ask you to do is get way out of the box and come up with financing mechanisms like these that you would be willing to support. And I say that you would be willing to support for this reason. None of what we do can be done unless we're willing to make our own investments, our own sacrifices, and our own choices. If we're prepared to pay a tax on our airline tickets, we can do something about health. If we are prepared to see our aid budget go up, we can do something about poverty. So again, I'd like to ask you to get as far out of the box as possible. I'm sorry the clock will run more tightly than usual. Arturo will announce when our time is narrowing, and then we'll come back for our final remarks. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do that whistle, but I'm about to try. I would like to make, ladies and gentlemen, could you please take your seats? Thank you. I'd like to make a brief apology and a promise. We're under some sharp time constraints to finish promptly at 5:30, so we are not going to be able to bring all of your findings up for response. I do give you my word, I have to summarize the Poverty Alleviation Working Group tomorrow in the plenary, and I promise you that your findings will be reflected then. So what we're going to do for the last 15 minutes, including because Jim Wolfenson wouldn't do what I told him to do even if I told him to do it, is to give the microphone back to our esteemed moderator, Jim Wolfenson, to take us through another round with the panelists and summarize where we've been and indeed where we must go. So, Jim, to you, and again, a final thanks to all the panelists.
Well, thank you so much. Look, we have a very unruly panel. It's not just me. And I would like to give free rein first to Darren, then to Maria, and finally to Gordon, because the only way we'll get out of here on time is if Gordon knows that we have to keep to his time limit. So let me start with Darren and say what you like, Darren.
I will be brief because it's easy for me to yield to the man to my right. What I will say is that in many countries in the developing world, there is underutilized capital. The notion that in developing countries there is not private capital is problematic, and it's factually not true. There is, and the data are clear, in many developing countries, capital flows out of those countries because the private sector is not investing. So we have to think about how we incentivize, how we capture the policies that are necessary to create the frameworks to get banks, to get financial institutions and insurance companies. I was at a conference recently, and a senior official in the Mexican government gave the statistics on the housing market in Mexico. The fact that banks can't find enough loans. There are billions of dollars held by multinational banks in Mexico that simply need to be catalyzed, need to be unleashed in that country. So we have to believe and we have to be focused on and relentless around this issue of capturing private capital in developing countries. So while I talked about New York and what we did here, there's a lot to learn. And I think for the bank, for donor agencies, to think about how to harness, channel, not crowd out, but to truly catalyze private capital will take us a long way towards reducing poverty in the developing world.
Darren, I think that's very incisive, and I think it's absolutely correct. The thing that has proven difficult is to get local entrepreneurs actually to do it. Your analysis is 100% right. You see it in some countries, it's coming, but if we could get from developed countries, businessmen, to go down there and by example and by talking and by training younger people there so that they can see what goes on, over a 5 or 10 year period, I absolutely agree with you. We will see what has happened in the general development field, which is a move from government funding, as Gordon Brown pointed out, much more to the private sector coming in and taking its responsibility. And it's happened internationally, but it does need to happen domestically. And Maria, you mentioned in your remarks that you were going to say something about innovative forms of financing, and you have a couple of minutes to do that.
I think the big question that we face in microfinance is the question of scale. We're reaching probably 60, 70 million clients right now, maybe a few more, when really the need is for hundreds of millions more, if not billions. So the question for us is that question of scale. And part of what we need is to be able to really bring capital into microfinance institutions in a way that will allow them to increase their scale. The example this morning of the initiative of Standard Charter, for example, of putting $500 million towards microfinance is one example, one idea of bringing capital from some of the largest institutions towards microfinance. And I think this is something that we need to continue moving forward. Clearly, the possibility of being able to issue paper in your local markets so that you can also be able to raise capital locally in local currency, which means it's even better because you don't have to suffer the risk of hard currency, is one way in which we also can be we can use in microfinance financial instruments that have been used, of course, on an ongoing basis. But we're using them to back up loans that are made in $100 amounts to women who are selling oranges on the street corner. That link is more innovative than I think one can describe. And I think these are the ways in which we are looking at addressing finance so that we can really expand what we need, what we can use in microfinance. Very combined with this is the enormous need that we have to build the capacity in microfinance institutions to also be able to absorb all that capital that we would be able to bring forward. But once we have that connection with the capital markets, I think we are in a very very exciting moment to be able to reach the scale that we need to.
I think thank you for that comment, and it leads me to ask Gordon a question in which he's been a leader. The nations of the world have said that they're ready to put up, or should put up, 0.7% of GDP for development assistance. And around the world, it averages maybe 0.2, 0.25. And the difference for which you have spoken of bridging by this advanced funding mechanism is one way of doing it. But to what extent do you see a change of heart in government? To what extent has your leadership been able to convince others that this is not a matter of charity, it's a matter of self-interest? Because with a billion people living under $1 a day and 2.5 billion living under $2 a day, and the world about to grow 3 billion in the next 40 years, principally in developing countries, if we don't solve this problem, this is not just a local charity. This is the question of global stability. And you, as truly, if I say this, one of the great leaders in this, how do you find the reaction from your government colleagues around the world, in this country, in other countries?
Well, this is the big issue. I was in a school, and Gladwin Ngozi, who's the former finance minister of Nigeria, is here with Ngozi in Abuja, just outside Abuja in Nigeria, a few weeks ago. And Bono was also there, who's done so much to publicize the need for action. But what amazed me there was first of all, the determination of the children to get the best education. And Bono was asking them, what did they want to do? And they're saying, engineers, doctors, nurses. Nobody seemed to want to be a finance minister. A lot of people wanted to be president. But here was a school. Here was a school.
Excuse me, or prime minister.
President. And Bono found not enough wanted to be a pop idol either. But here were kids, three to a desk, 150 in a classroom, 150 to one, if you like, the pupil-teacher ratio, the school building falling down, worries about violence from the outside. And then Bonner described to me that he'd been around the country, and not far away there was a madrasas being set up, religious extremist indoctrination being practiced. And if we do not provide the schools and make it possible for these to exist, then be in no doubt that the security issue that we worry about in relation to Afghanistan, and we worry about in relation to Iraq, and we worry about in relation to the Arab states, is going to be a huge issue in relation to some of the poorest countries in the world where terrorist propaganda is being spread. And I believe that the combination of the moral imperative we all talk about and the strategic need to be prepared for what might happen in the future will mean that these development issues that are important to all of us who are here today come right to the center of the agenda. To prepare for this, some of the staff in my office did some figures. In Rwanda today, there are 7 million people, and there are a total of 50 midwives. In Mozambique, we have nearly 20 million people, and there are a total of only 500 doctors in all. If you look around Africa, the provision of what are fairly basic public services, then the lack of provision is a standing indictment on the whole of humanity. But what is exciting about being here and listening to people is that these problems can be solved by innovative ideas, as long as there is political will to see them through. And I would urge the business community here to keep thinking about how we can do things better, to build on the examples that we've just been given about how microcredit, which was originally seen as a small idea, has become one of the biggest ideas of our time. To listen to what has been done by Darren in providing innovative ways of sharing risk to make it possible to do housing and infrastructure projects. And if you take the most recent example of what we've got to do, which is to provide a trade settlement that is equitable to the poorest countries of the world, but moves forward world growth in a way that protectionist sentiment would hold it back, then we will need to come up with plans for infrastructure so that African and other developing countries are able to trade with the rest of the world. For many of them, it's not the tariff that's the problem. It is the lack of infrastructure, communications, the lack of telecommunications, the lack of roads, a lack of basic infrastructure to enable goods to get to market. And we will need private-public partnerships to make that work. And Jim knows better than most that the scale of the funds for even water that are needed to make infrastructure work are massive. This will need innovative thinking. And I believe that here in America, you have some of the most innovative thinkers so that we can actually move this forward as a joint public-private partnership. So my appeal is not for you to support any one particular project, but to keep thinking about the ideas that can make public-private partnerships that can work in developed countries, adjusted to developing countries, because in that lies, as I keep wanting to remind you today, a solution not simply to the moral outrage of poverty in the poorest countries, but to some of the security problems that could tear the world apart. And please submit all your ideas, and I believe that the political movements here are prepared to listen. Thank you very much.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think we've all been privileged today with both sessions. But in particular, I thanked already the first group. Let me thank our speakers that are with me here on the panel. What I hope we all go away with is that poverty is not just one of four sessions that you could pick. Poverty, for me, and I think for my colleagues here, is the fundamental issue of our time. If you do not have an approach in scale by all of us to understand that poverty in other parts of the world is a matter of self-interest for us, it is not just a matter of charity. The numbers are too great to think of it in anything other than an issue of global stability. If you have a billion plus people living under a dollar a day, with the communication systems that we have, and whatever few people there are who are malevolent and who can use these people, we have a real challenge in terms both of security, in terms of equity, in terms of social justice, in terms of peace. And I hope that you go away from these sessions today thinking that everyone can do something about it. But hugely important is to get your kids to understand, to get your neighbors to understand, to talk about it, that the issue is not a distant issue. This is an issue that affects everybody in this room. And I'm hugely grateful to the speakers today for bringing this home. We've given you some practical things that you can do, but I would urge you to modulate your thinking to understand that this is not one of four sessions this afternoon. This is where it's at, and if you want your kids to live in peace, you have to deal with this issue. I want you to join me in thanking our speakers, and thank you very much.
And let me join in thanking all of you and just do something very quickly, if I may. And I beg your indulgence, there's 45 seconds left, here I go. You asked us to think about innovation, and we have here people who care enough about this issue to come here prepared to make a commitment. And I just want to share with you what people came up with in 15 minutes. An Africa hedge fund, a philanthropic wanted column, which sounds quite intriguing to me, socially responsible transactional surcharges, MP3 downloads, ATM withdrawals, microfinance bonds, a Community Reinvestment Act for the developing world, and a developing stock exchange. If we can do that in 15 minutes, think of what we can and must do in the next year and in a lifetime. And I am indebted to our speakers and to all of you for proving that we can actually do this. And I do believe that the political will that was referenced at the beginning of this panel is in this room and alive. And let us do it. Thank you. Thank you.